Case number 12-1036. Hugh B. Kaufman, Petitioner v. Thomas E. Perez, Secretary of the United States Department of Labor. Ms. Markey for the petitioner, Ms. Romehill for the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, Regina Markey for Hugh B. Kaufman. I have 10 minutes and I've asked two for rebuttal. In this case, we concede that our first claim having to do with the preclusion of Mr. Kaufman's ombudsman duties in 2000 by the administration of EPA Administrator Browner is time barred. We concede that. The appeal is about what happened after that. The Administrative Review Board of the Department of Labor made an error in finding that Mr. Kaufman's seven claims before you are time barred. And the reason that it made an error was that it failed to consider whether the seven claims were motivated by retaliatory intent by the new EPA administrator and her staff, Christine Todd Whitman.
You have to have new adverse action before you have a new animus inquiry, don't you?
That's correct.
If they had fired him after his first mess up here, could he have come back and started the clock over by asking him every 30 days and not still fired? Would that have worked?
Under the correct standard here, which is Morgan, every time a new intentionally discriminatory act
I
is planned.
We started with that premise. And
yes.
I'm asking you the question.
Yes.
If the initial adverse action had been the firing rather than taking him off,
I'm sorry.
Start the clock over by coming in every 30 days and saying, am I still fired?
I think the particular facts would have to be reviewed in terms of whether there was new retaliatory
intent. Have the facts. Don't fight the hypothetical.
Excuse me?
You have the facts.
Yes.
Don't fight the hypothetical. The
okay.
Facts are... All they have is he comes back in and says, am I still fired? They say yes. Is that an adverse action that restarts the clock?
I would say yes, that is
he
an adverse action.
Yes. He can restart the clock perpetually by coming back in and asking if he's still fired.
It depends on the particular circumstance, Your Honor. Here we have a policy. We're not talking about just a particular position. We're talking about a policy that was adopted by the EPA, and Mr. Kaufman could not undertake ombudsman duties. If I could
that
focus...
That is not a policy any more than firing him would have been a policy.
No, because the court makes... The case law makes a distinction between particular discrete acts and a broad policy. For instance, I mentioned case law in five different circuits that found that even if a discrete act is related to acts outside a particular limitation period here, which is 30 days, it still restarts the limitation clock as long as it's taken by an intentionally discriminatory policy. And I would say, as an example, in this court, there's a case law that states that salary discrimination, if the salary structure itself is discriminatory, every paycheck received restarts the limitation period. And we would argue here, and we assert it's true, that this is a similar policy. That's what Morgan implemented. If Morgan allows an employee to come back and the employee can show that there was intentional discrimination, then the intentional discrimination restarts limitation period.
But under the hypothetical that Judge Santel gave you, which is where somebody is fired and then they come back and it's just, let's suppose it's just an administrative response. It's a turnaround of a document that says, you know, you're fired, why are you back? There's no indication that there's any thought given to that. It's just an automatic response to the fact that you've already been fired. In that context, are you saying that that action, the reiteration of the firing that has already taken place, would restart the clock anew?
I would say if it was taken based on a discriminatory policy, yes.
So even if all the evidence of discrimination, and I'll call it a policy, but I don't know that it's fair to call a decision with respect to a particular person as a policy. But the decision to fire the person has already been made, and the allegation is made that that decision was premised upon illicit discrimination. Later on, the person comes back and asks for the job back. There's just an administrative response to the effect, you've already been fired, why are you back here? No new evidence of discrimination. Nothing else happens other than it's spit out.
Let me clarify. No, that would not be a new adverse action if there's no evidence of discrimination. No.
But there is evidence, just to paint the picture fully, the allegation is that there was discrimination in the initial firing.
Correct.
So let's presuppose that there was discrimination in the initial firing. Outside the time window for that.
Mm-hmm.
You're inside the time window for the point in time at which the person comes back and says, I want to revisit whether I was fired. I'd like to get my job back. And the employer just says, without anything other than the initial decision in hand, you're still fired. I don't know what you're doing here. You're still fired.
Under that fact pattern, absolutely, there's no new discrete act and no adverse action.
Okay.
Yes.
And you're saying this case is different from that?
Yes, because there was tremendous protected activity, whistleblowing activity, in the new administration by my client, Mr. Kaufman. And unfortunately, it doesn't appear in the decision of the ALJ below or the board, because they didn't even consider whether there was new whistleblowing, whether there was new retaliation. There was absolutely no consideration of any of that. And we assert that under Morgan, there was a requirement to look at that. First of all, under Morgan, if you plead that there was an intentionally retaliatory act, that restarts the limitation period. Once you plead it, then the analysis must ensue as to whether, in fact, there was new retaliation that was associated with that particular discrete act that you pled within the 30-day limitation period.
So I guess one way to read the ALJ's decision is not that it was not considered, but that it was considered and rejected. Because what the ALJ said is the subsequent acts, the discrete acts, the seven discrete acts that you're pointing to that post-date the one that's concededly time-barred, the subsequent acts were just natural consequences of what had already happened. There was no new discrimination associated with those. They were simply implementations of the decision that had already been reached.
We would argue there was no real analysis of whether they were just mere implementation or whether they involved new retaliation by the administration of Administrator Whitman. And I would say, Your Honor, as far as this, the last two claims, which have to do with the elimination of the ombudsman function, there's a clear record on the evidence that Mr. Kaufman could have continued ombudsman duties, and that would be at Joint Appendix 1099, where the EPA stipulated on the record that Mr. Kaufman could have resumed ombudsman duties. So, because he could resume them, it shows that the ALJ and the Administrative Board erred in finding that Mr. Kaufman was permanently precluded, because he was not. And that's what's different about, for instance, a termination, where there is a permanence to that, whereas here, this was more of a policy that was reconsidered by the administration of Administrator Whitman. And it's very clear that Mr. Kaufman's supervisor was pursuing a plan under which Mr. Kaufman would have been reinstated as the chief investigator for the ombudsman.
In the submissions before the ALJ, did you make the argument that you appear to now be making, which is that the subsequent discrete acts were born of new independent discrimination on the part of the new administration that had come in.
Yes, Judge Srinivasan. Yes.
You spelled out the argument in the same way.
Yes.
Where is our best place to find that in the appendix?
Where, in my brief?
In the joint appendix.
Oh, in the joint appendix? I guess we would have to look at the summary by the administrative law judge.
No, you're saying you spelled out that.
Yeah, I said that I did. We didn't include our briefs before the administrative law judge in the joint appendix, but I can provide them to you if you like that, if you'd like to see whether we argued that, because that was clearly our argument. And we put a tremendous amount of evidence on the record, which I did cite in my appeal brief, as to Mr. Kaufman's protected activity in...
you did not put that in your appeal brief, did you? What you're saying now?
Yes, absolutely.
New protected activity?
Absolutely. In my appeal brief on page 18 and 24 and 25. I believe my time is up.
Okay.
Do you have any other questions?
All right. We'll give you some time to reply.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Brumhill?
May it please the Court, my name is Dean Romheld, and I represent the Secretary of Labor in this matter. The agency correctly applied the applicable principles regarding statute of limitations in this case. Those principles are set forth in two cases by the Supreme Court, the Morgan case and the Ricks case. The counsel for Mr. Kaufman suggested that simply pleading the discrete act is sufficient to trigger the restarting of a statute of limitations, and that's just simply not correct. What happened here is that they were pled, and the ALJ found that the fact that Kaufman had pled the seven discrete acts following the removal of his duties, found that survived a motion to dismiss at the hearing stage. After that, the ALJ held an extensive 14-day hearing where he heard from witnesses, accepted evidence, and made a bunch of factual findings. In that process, at that point, he evaluated the merits of the seven discrete acts alleged by Mr. Kaufman. And he determined, consistent with Morgan and consistent with Ricks, that none of those seven discrete acts had any sort of independent harm towards Mr. Kaufman. And that's the key distinction laid out by Morgan and Ricks. Morgan does require that the judge look at these discrete acts and see if those discrete acts, standing alone, trigger a new limitations period.
But well, I guess one thing I'm not understanding about what you just said is you're focusing on independent harm.
Right.
So take as a given that the harm doesn't escalate. In other words, you use the example that Judge Santel started with. You're fired, you stay fired, so there's no new harm. But suppose that when the person comes back and said, I'd like to have my job back, the allegation is that when you denied me the request to reconsider the initial firing, you discriminated against me again because I see a memo in your file that says, you know, I'm not even sure that this person should have been fired in the first place, but boy, they're a whistleblower, so I'm not going to give them the job back now. Suppose they did that. Would you say that because there's no additional harm, it's still outside the time period? Would you say, well, now there's no additional harm, but the allegation is that the denial of reconsideration, if you will, was infected by a new breed of discrimination. And because there's a new species of discrimination that's being alleged now, that's a new claim, and that's within the statutory time period.
If the second action is independently discriminatory, then it would be actionable.
Even though there's no new harm. Even though the effect of it is that it's a ratification of the old decision. In other words, the effect is you're still fired, so you get no relief. But the reason given for the conclusion that you're still fired is that you're a whistleblower.
I mean, the key is the distinction between whether it's independently discriminatory or just simply a delay but inevitable consequence of the earlier action. The facts, as the ALJ found them here, suggested that, I mean, let's focus on the specific seven discrete acts that were identified here. The first three can be grouped in a category where essentially after removal of Mr. Kaufman's duties, the EPA took several actions to find somebody else to perform those duties. The ALJ looked at those, the detailing of another employee, the lifting of a hiring freeze, and you know, an exception to hire and freeze and you know, a request from the Mr. Fields or Mr. Shapiro to fill the position. And the ALJ concluded, based on the facts and as affirmed by the ARB, that those were simply a delay but inevitable consequence of you know, removing him from the duties in the first place. The second set of discrete acts identified by Mr. Kaufman were basically reiterations of the existing prohibition.
What's the best indication in the ALJ's opinion that the ALJ, in fact, considered the notion that there was independent discrimination that infected the subsequent acts and then rejected it? Because I take your point that if that argument, in fact, was presented, and counsel has said that it was presented, and the ALJ considered it and rejected it, well, that's something that is of significant benefit to you. But her argument is it was never even considered, that it was just applied as a matter of course to say there was already a decision made, this was just a reassertion of that old decision, we're done. We don't even need to look to see whether the reassertion of the old decision was infected by independent, allegedly infected by independent discrimination.
I'm not sure that I can identify for you a clear place in the ALJ's decision that demonstrates that he thought about the issue in the way that you just suggested.
Is that your understanding of what happened with the ALJ's decision, is that it wasn't just a failure to consider, but it was a consideration and rejection?
I mean, my understanding is based on the same information that's before you,
mm-hmm.
and
okay.
It's based on the ALJ's decision, whatever's in the record.
Is that your argument?
Well, my argument is that he, based on the facts as he found them, he determined that there was nothing independently discriminatory about any of the discrete acts alleged by Mr. Kaufman as somehow salvaging the timeliness or the untimeliness of his claim. And he went through each of the, you know, as required by Morgan, he went through each of the independent acts, discrete acts. He considered each of the discrete acts, and he determined that they were not independently harmful and independently discriminatory. I mean, I think those words are interchangeable. But he determined
I don't know that they are interchangeable. Because, and that's, I think, part of at least my slight confusion on this is that there's a difference between independently harmful and independently discriminatory, in that it may be that you suffer no additional quantum of harm because you're still fired. But there may be independent discrimination that led to the determination that you're still fired.
Again, the ALJ considered each of the discriminatory acts, and he considered them as required by Morgan and as complemented by the Ricks case. And evaluating the particular discrete acts alleged here, he determined that they fell into the category of inevitable consequences of the December 14th removal of his duties. I mean, obviously, when you remove the duties, if you take away an employee's duties, that obviously creates a gap and that needs to be filled, and the EPA took actions to find somebody else to perform those duties. When somebody continues to request to perform those duties, I guess in the hypothetical that Judge Santel mentioned earlier, those requests were denied. In each case, there was reference back to the December 14, 2000 removal of his duties in each case. There was no suggestion that there was some sort of independent inquiry undertaken. I mean, there are multiple letters from Mr. Shapiro to either Mr. Kaufman or Mr. Martin, who was the ombudsman, saying, as you know, Mr. Kaufman has been barred from performing these duties since December 14, 2000. Several of those cases, and on several of those occasions, Mr. Shapiro attached the December 14, 2000 memo. On each case where he rejected that sort of request after the fact, he referred back to the decision that was already taken December 2000. There's no suggestion that there was some sort of independent analysis or that the hypothetical that you suggested actually corresponds to the facts here. It was a reiteration or enforcement of an existing decision that was made. And then finally,
I'm not trying to belabor the point, but I think everything you say can be a conclusion drawn from this record, to be sure. And if what you say is true, then the legal conclusion that you're putting forward follows.
Yeah.
I definitely grant you that under Morgan and the other cases. I think the question is whether that's in fact the analysis that was undertaken by the ALJ that we're charged with reviewing.
And I'm not I'm not sure I can answer that question. I'm not sure that question is answerable. It's obviously what we have before us, or okay. the ALJ's decision. And to the extent that what I've been saying is a conclusion that can be drawn from the record before us, I mean, here we are on a substantial evidence standard of review. Whether the particular discrete acts fall within the category of delayed inevitable consequences are actually independently discriminatory, you know, after I correctly identifying the two categories, determining based on the record which category the discrete acts fall into, I mean, that's a factual decision, and that's reviewed for substantial evidence. So to the extent that the record supports that conclusion, that's sufficient to satisfy the substantial evidence standard, which is somewhere, as this Court has said, somewhere between a scintilla of the evidence but less than a preponderance of the evidence. Are there any further questions?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Markey, does she have any time? All right. Why don't you take a couple minutes?
I wanted to ask, would you like me to provide you the brief that we provided to the administrative law judge below?
I would like you to.
Yes, I'll do that. Would you like the other side's brief as well? I can provide both.
Yes,
yeah, no problem. Sure. as to the statute of limitation, we assert that the correct standard for the agency's failure to apply Morgan correctly is de novo, with no Chevron deference, because the agency has no particular authority to interpret Title VII. Once they adopt the Title VII standard, they have no particular authority to interpret it. I would point out, to distinguish the Ricks case, is under Ricks there was only one discrete act that was pled, whereas here we have numerous discrete acts, and we do assert that the analysis under Morgan must occur for each particular act. And my last point would be that the ALJ, and then as adopted by the Administrative Review Board, failed really to do any analysis of the claims 7 and 8, which have to do with the transfer of the ombudsman function. And so we believe that there was a failure for them even to provide a correct analysis. Do you have any other questions?
I have one. This is such an old case. Is Mr. Coughlin still at EPA?
Yes, he is.
And where is he?
Basically relegated to a small...
Well, just tell me the office he's in. You don't need to describe it.
I believe he's still in the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response.
Okay. Can you get the briefs in, please, no later than Friday?
Yes. Thank you very much, all of you. Have a good afternoon.